This is a motto that we developed for use in HR, and it actually used to be the reverse. It used to be mission first, people always. And then when I stepped up into the role, we sort of led the charge to say, no, we should go to the people first. And here's why. You sort of don't have mission without people. So, and a lot of times, you know, that gets lost, especially when you see, you know, pictures of all these wonderful things floating around in space and helicopters on Mars. And it's easy to forget that that all came from the people who made it happen.
That was NASA Chief Human Capital Officer, Jane Datta. And in this episode, Jane and I discuss her career and work leading the people team at one of the most recognized brands on the planet. We discuss how they approach recruiting in a high-volume environment, how they were somewhat insulated by the Great Resignation, and the importance of representation in the Artemis III mission, and so much more. And we'll be right back with that conversation after a brief word from our sponsor. It's time to let go of the past perceptions of HR. Amplify is a new model of agency design from the ground up to support business and people leaders navigate the new world of work. We do that through two platforms. Our HR executive search practice is a new model of agency that moves away from traditional transactional search models with our flat fee pricing structure and advisory on the front and back end to help our clients attract and retain transformational people leaders. Our Amplify Academy is a unique platform to support continuous learning and build readiness, capability, and global networks for today's HR practitioners and leaders through the AI Learning Lab, peer learning cohort programs, community, and a range of resources to support their growth. You can learn more at amplifytalent.com. Now, on to the show. Hey everyone, welcome to Redefining HR Podcast. I'm your host, Laura Schmidt. And today's a real treat. I'm really excited to be sitting down with Jane Datta. Jane is the Chief Human Capital Officer at NASA. And it's an agency you may have heard of. You may have followed some of the work that they have done. I certainly have as a boy growing up in South Florida, watching shuttles take off on a regular basis. And so I have so many questions and I want to dig right in. Jane, thanks so much for joining the podcast. I'd love to have you open with an introduction for the audience.
Thanks, Lars. It's a great pleasure to be here. So I am the Chico of NASA. That's what we call ourselves. That's the equivalent of the CHRO in industry. I've been with NASA since early 2000s, and I stepped into this role in January of 2020, which, as you all will recall, was right before the pandemic hit. So it's been an interesting experience being in this role at this agency during these few years.
You know, I have so much empathy for people who moved into those roles at that time. Yes. In the world and kind of what you've experienced. So that might open up a whole nother series of questions that, you know, we may have to cover. But let's go back to the beginning, because I know that you were, if I recall correctly, you were consulting, you know, within the agency before you kind of moved in-house, but you've been working in HR the majority of your career. Let's go back to the beginning. Like, what originally drew you to the field?
Well, when I was in business school, I approached it knowing that I was open for a career change, and I had lots of different options, different, you know, roads I could have gone down post-business school. And I landed pretty quickly on HR. And I think the reason I did was that it was like this nice combination of being analytical and creative and very people-focused. And all my experience to that point had been in very people-focused roles and organizations. And so I knew that's what I needed. And so that's what I pursued.
And it's interesting. I mean, you've seen so much evolution in the field over that time. And, you know, it's interesting. I think I've been, you know, working in the space for about 25 years now, and even just seeing the evolution over that period of time, but in particular the last couple of years, so much has changed and so much has shifted. And again, you know, you're kind of overseeing the human capital strategy for a massive agency, again, moving into that role, as you mentioned, right in the early days of the pandemic. You know, before getting into the nature of kind of your work and projects at NASA, let's level set a bit, because I imagine, I mean, NASA is probably one of the most recognizable brands, companies, you know, brand, I would say, from a marketing perspective, but on the planet, right? There are very few people who don't have any idea of what NASA is. But I imagine many people outside of some of your missions don't necessarily know what NASA is like, you know, behind the scenes. So could you kind of walk us through approximate, you know, number of employees, locations, and then within your kind of human capital team specifically, how are you structured to support that group?
So NASA consists of what I would call mission areas. There are four technical mission areas. So there's human spaceflight, so Artemis, shuttle, etc. There is science, so think DART, that was just recently accomplished, the DART mission, and the rovers, and the James Webb Space Telescope, etc. We also have space technology, and we have aeronautics, so, you know, things like electric airplanes and the airspace. So we cover a lot of different aspects of this whole industry area. And, you know, we do that through what the field center model. So we have 10 field centers dotted across the country. You've heard of many of them, I'm sure. You know, you have Johnson Space Center in Houston and Kennedy in Florida, just as examples, and there are others. And what we do is we have about 18,000 civil servants distributed across the field centers and the headquarters in the Washington, D.C. area. And we essentially matrix that mission work to the workforce that is organized in those field centers. So that's kind of the basics. It's also important to note, you know, the civil service workforce is only one component and not the largest one of what we consider to be our overall workforce. We've got contractors, prime contractors, support service contractors, like most government agencies do. We also have partners in industry. We also have international partners. And so there are a lot of, you could go broad and say that our workforce is a whole bunch of things. And civil service, though, is kind of at the core of it. And for my work, it is largely about the civil service population as the sort of anchor for the NASA workforce. From an HR perspective, it used to be that there were, you know, HR offices in each field center, and there still are. However, they were decentralized. And about 5 years ago, all the business functions at NASA were consolidated, and including HR. So that means that I now have a staff of, well, 500. That's a mix of civil servants and contractors that are spread out to do the work of human capital at NASA. So it's allowed us to focus on efficiencies and, you know, really improving and modernizing how we do our business.
And it's interesting to get a sense of like how the different, you know, mission teams are structured and kind of what sits where, because you hear of a mission like DART, right? That was the most recent high-profile mission, which is just mind-boggling when you think of the complexity of hitting an asteroid, you know, millions and millions of miles away in a multi-year effort. But I want to come back actually to that piece, sort of talked about planning for some of the projects that you have to design that are of that nature. But yeah, it's interesting to get a sense of like how you're structured to support that. And with your mission within HR of kind of people first, mission always, what does that mean? How does that kind of inform how you think about designing the people strategy?
This is a motto that we developed for use in HR. And it actually used to be the reverse. It used to be mission first, people always. And then when I stepped up into the role, we sort of led the charge to say, no, we should go to the people first. And here's why. You sort of don't have mission without people. So, and a lot of times, you know, that gets lost, especially when you see, you know, pictures of all these wonderful things floating around in space and helicopters on Mars. And it's easy to forget that that all came from the people who made it happen. Moreover, and maybe as importantly, I think, it's about the curiosity and creativity of humans that has enabled or driven us to the point where we want to actually go do these things, explore the origins of the universe, right? That's a very human, it's a very human desire. And so in human capital, with the employee-driven programs, knowing that the workforce is first, that we're really thinking of what workforce we need and how to make sure that they are engaged and have what they need to bring their full selves to work, it just made sense to have the motto that way around. I'll also say we did that knowing that at NASA, you know, we really are pretty people focused, you know, top down and across. So what that means is we were adopting a motto that actually could resonate across the agency inside, but also outside of HR.
I'm curious, did you get any resistance, right, when you made that shift? Because everything you've described makes sense, but I'm also guessing if there was kind of a longly, a well-established kind of motto, you know, did shifting the order of that ruffle any feathers?
Actually, it didn't. In fact, I got in the opposite. I got like, yeah, you know, thank you. You know, I like that. It works. And so I will say we have never looked back. Since we changed that order. So,
well, you know, one of the things that just kind of fascinates me about, you know, a role like yours in an environment like NASA is, you know, for most CPOs, CHROs, heads of human capital, whatever the title might be, you know, you're working in an organizational strategic business plan. You usually have, you know, 2 to 3 year roadmap for the business. You're developing a people strategy that helps the business achieve those goals over those kind of usual periods of time. But you're working in a different environment. You're working and supporting missions that have a, you know, 3 to 5 to 10 or more year kind of lifespan. And especially in the backdrop under which you're operating today, where there's so much volatility you know, in the world and how we think about working. And I mean, obviously, when you designed the talent strategy for the DART mission, I'm guessing that was probably pre-pandemic. And then lots of things changed, of course, during the pandemic that you have to adapt to, even though you're kind of years into a multi-year strategy. How do you do that? Like, how do you think about designing, you know, talent strategies and people strategies for these multi-year kind of long tail missions?
Well, let me just say, you know, it isn't easy and we're not perfect. However, this is how I look at it. These long-term missions require us to have some amount of stability in our workforce. And in fact, Title V, the civil service framework that we all operate in, kind of encourages that sort of consistency, right? And that has benefited us. However, it's also important for us to have some agility to accommodate changes that may not have been foreseen. And so there are a couple of ways that we do that. One is there is quite a bit of interoperability. So, you know, we have engineers, but engineers might have worked on a specific program for a while, but actually are very transferable over to other types of work. Not everybody is interoperable with everything, so I don't mean to imply that, but I think we have a sense of, you know, we have what I would call skilled athletes, if you will, that you can move around to do different things within reasonable boundaries. And so, and that has been our way of addressing change all along. I think what we're looking at now, though, as we look in outside of NASA and into the ecosystem where we play, is that there is perhaps, whilst we still have, you know, these very decadal missions, right, both in many of our mission areas, including in human spaceflight, we also have a growing industry around us. It's maturing in certain ways, especially now that we are successful with, say, the commercial crew program, and we have partners, and so more is happening around us. And so there, what we've determined is that we really need to focus on being agile and demand driven, right? And so one of the ways that we have addressed that is we've kind of adopted this idea that some of our workforce needs to be more project-based, and so that they don't come necessarily with the expectation of being at NASA for their entire careers, or perhaps better said, being in roles for long periods of time. So that gives us a little bit more flexibility to change the size and the mix of the workforce as things unfold. Because we can't necessarily predict exactly what will happen or on what time scale it will happen. But we know change is upon us. And so we need a little bit more flexibility than we've had before. So I would say that is a key difference to how we've been thinking about how much flexibility we need in the civil service, particularly. Obviously, we also have contracts and support service contractors, and that's another way in which we can mold and shape, the specific technical needs that we have closer to when we know that we need them. So that's another feature of how it is that we address change and the reshaping of the workforce at any moment in time.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that overview. And I think, it's interesting. I would imagine, and I'll ask because I want to know for sure, but I'd imagine for a lot of employees, like NASA is like the pinnacle of their career, right? If they can get into NASA, that's a job that they will hold on to for as long as they can. And there's great sides of that, and there's challenges to that as well. And I'm curious, like in your contemporaries, and we're in a bit of a different economy today than we were 6 or 8 months ago. But going back to that period of time when all we talked about was the Great Resignation, did you find yourself insulated from that? Like, what was your attrition like in that environment where, your peers were really kind of, pulling their hair out, trying to hold on to talent and draw talent?
So I would answer by saying that we were partially insulated from aspects of it. So let me explain what I mean. We have typically had a low attrition rate at the agency, anywhere from 3 to 6%. Often depending upon the state of the economy. Most of our attrition is retirements. So we can sort of, we can't fully predict it, but we can estimate reasonably what we would expect to see, partly who's retirement eligible, how many do we have, what percentage, how long do people tend to stay, et cetera. So you can do the math behind the scenes. So we typically have a low attrition rate. I actually think there is something known as too low attrition rate, but I did expect and did see some uptick in attrition, both in retirement and in resignations. But we're not talking about like a really high. It's more like we were at the 6 to 7% versus in the lower end of what we typically do. So what I would say in being insulated is that we have not yet seen losses that are outside of the boundaries of what we've experienced in the past. And so it's not a supranormal level. But where we weren't insulated, and here's what I think really matters about this, is that we weren't insulated from the impacts of all the debates around future of work and the balancing of your work life with your other responsibilities and the degree to which you feel connected to what you are doing and needing to have some flexibility in choices. So we were not insulated from that. And because of that, we took very seriously, how do we address sort of all the new possibilities that future of work has brought to us through COVID, really? I mean, we probably advanced a good decade in terms of how do we work virtually, and that allows us to work asynchronously and more at home than before, and or at third locations that are not home or office, just for that matter. But the point being, we knew that we had to do that reasonably, and we had to take into account how the employee's viewpoint in all of this, because I think we can continue to be an employer of choice if we do this well. And I think we are doing it well. We're not there. Nobody's really figured all of this out, honestly. But I do think that we have demonstrated intent, and we have taken a lot of effort to both work with leadership hear from employees and then do the sense making on top of all that. You know, I think this is really critical. And I know that our employees care about this. And if we don't pay attention, I think they'll let us know. And in one way or another, whether that's I leave the agency or I just let you know. And we need to listen. And so that's why I think we're not fully insulated, nor should we be, from what that was all about.
As an HR practitioner navigating the new world of work, your ability to learn, connect with resources, and build your global peer community is essential to your success. That's why I launched the Amplify Academy. The Amplify Academy was built from the ground up to help HR practitioners and people leaders efficiently and effectively connect with the diverse learning needs and resources for today and tomorrow. There are three components to the Academy. The Learning Lab is an AI learning platform that includes a range of courses, resources, templates, content, and more to support the learning needs around modern HR practices for today and tomorrow. The Amplify Academy Slack community is designed to help you build your global network equity and peer set with practitioners around the world who share your vision for progressive HR practices. And the Amplify Academy cohorts are four-week immersive peer learning programs designed to help people leaders build the skills and network they need to succeed as an HR leader in today's environment. Cohort students also learn from world-class people leaders from Katie Burke, Pat Waters, Claude Silver, Brian Power, AJ Thomas, and so many more. Want to supercharge your people team? Be sure to check out the Academy for Teams product, which is designed to give you and your people teams access to over 400 resources, the full community, and more across the Amplify Academy. Learn more at amplifytalent.com/academy. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate raising that point. And I think it's also probably interesting. I mean, a lot of your employees, I imagine, have friends and families, some working in government roles, some working in the private sector. And so part of, you know, I think what fuels the conversations around, hey, why don't we have this, is when they talk to their peers and friends who do have that in their company. Maybe it's a different industry, different circumstances. That rarely matters. I think it's just, but they get to do this and I should get to do this. And it's interesting. I think that this kind of push and pull sounds adversarial, and I don't mean it to be, but this kind of negotiation, I would say, is a better way to frame it, with employees who, you know, coming out of the pandemic, they do have different drivers personally, professionally. They do have different things that they want from the workplace. And so, you know, finding that, hearing them, and then finding that middle ground with them, I think is an art that will continue to, you know, navigate into next year.
I completely agree with you. And as I say, I don't think anyone's really figured this out, but we know better answers versus worse answers to that are responses to these employees standing up and saying, you know, it's not all about a paycheck and following the rules. You know, I also think that organizations stand to benefit a great deal from making this work. Because if you actually enable your employees to feel like, you know, they have some flexibility and they can find ways to be productive that don't just follow the standard mechanisms, I think we'll see that engagement and that productivity. And that's a benefit to them and to the organization. So we really must. And I think, you know, we're trying, and I think we've made some good strides, and we're going to figure out where we go. We declared most of 2022 to be kind of an experimental phase in this, and so that we didn't declare anything with, say, office spaces and utilization and things that are sort of attendant to where and when people work questions. So we're still putting quite a bit of resource and effort to trying to come out into 2023 with some really thoughtful approaches to all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think a lot of your contemporaries are also taking that approach of kind of iterating in shorter term intervals. So, you know, you're not trying to make a definitive situation for a reality that we're not in yet. right? And you have, because it's really hard. I think companies that have struggled are the ones that have said, hey, it's definitely this. And then, well, it's going to be this. I mean, even going back to last year with, you know, return to workplace and then Delta, no. And then return to workplace and Omicron, no.
Yeah,
and
it was exactly.
Just, you know, this constant shifting. And that, I think, has just caused a lot of frustration for employees because, you know, again, some of them moved. Many of them have different, you know, life circumstances in terms of childcare and things like that. So it's, yeah, it's interesting. I think when you're doing, you know, approaching it in those shorter cycles, I think gives you just more flexibility without, you know, setting an expectation with employees that you can't hold because maybe you are going to change something you've already committed to.
Perfectly said. Yeah.
What was your, you know, you work in such a unique environment and atmosphere because, again, the mission-driven element of expanding, you know, mankind's horizons, I think will resonate with anybody who's remotely curious about the universe that we live in. But you're also working in very high stakes missions and environments. And I'm curious, you know, what was your hardest day at NASA?
My hardest day at NASA was probably when the pandemic was clearly a pandemic. And because what it did was it pressed on that very most important thing to us, which is employee safety and wellness. For lots of obvious reasons, we take employee safety incredibly seriously at NASA. And it's one of our core values, and we absolutely must put that at the top of the list. And so one of the things that we did with the help of the entire leadership team, up to and including the administrator, by the way, was to say, workforce is first. You go home, and even if it has an impact on mission, I don't care, safety is first. And so, but it took us a little while. I mean, I think everybody in the entire world was caught off guard by the pandemic. And so the reason it was such a tough day was there's this sense of, I don't have anything that's a reference model for this. I've not been through a pandemic. I don't know how to, you know, to organize all of this. Luckily, everybody else was saying the same thing. And it was one of those moments where the leadership team kind of coalesced really super quickly. So I wanted to help figure it out, but I wasn't alone. I mean, that's the coda to that day where you're like, oh my gosh, this is real. And I don't know what's next. So anyway, I think it was one of those things where it was a really hard day, but it led to some really good things and good demonstrations of who we are as an agency that I will forever remember. And which I think we still demonstrate every day now, even though the pandemic is waning largely behind us. I'm going to say that and then it won't be, but fingers crossed.
I catch myself sometimes saying, now that we're, you know, approaching the other side of the pandemic, now, I don't really know how to talk about it without feeling like I'm like out of my league. So I'm optimistically hopeful about the diminished impact of the pandemic on our lives and society. I guess maybe that would be. I just came up with it on the fly. I guess that'll work. What I want to get back to a mission question, and that is the upcoming Artemis mission. Well, upcoming, already begun, but more specifically, Artemis 3, which you know, for those of you that aren't familiar with the Artemis mission, it is getting back to the moon with kind of laying the foundation for eventually getting to Mars. And one of the aspects of Artemis 3 that you've already kind of come forward with is that there will be a person of color and a woman landing on the moon, both making history. And, you know, the importance of the representation in that decision and the commitment to DEIA, which I know is kind of how you frame it within the agency, I would love to just learn a little bit more about kind of, you know, the how DEIA, maybe if you could just define that for the audience who may be new to the term, and then just talk a bit more about how that impacts decisions like that and kind of your strategy for the agency.
Absolutely. So DEIA is a government-wide, federal government-wide, I should say, term for the, for diversity, which is otherwise known as DEI or DEIB or various other. The A at the end references accessibility. And so that's its definition. So what I would say is DEIA isn't just an action plan that has a beginning and a middle and an end. It is It's a value. In fact, we added inclusion, which is, of course, part of DEIA, as one of our core values of the agency a few years ago. But one of the things that's really important for DEIA to really take hold and be present in front of our minds in almost everything that we do is having the agency really demonstrate it in very obvious and meaningful ways. And so I think that the declaration of having the first woman and the first person of color land on the moon was a way of saying, this is because the talent that we need to do all of these things is inclusive of, you know, people from all walks of life. It is a diverse mix. And that this was a way of honoring it and respecting it, knowing that it would be a really wonderful thing that would have kind of a spillover effect into a lot of other efforts that we have going on, anything from equity in procurement to diversity in hiring to all these other things. So what I'd say is DEIA is never done and it's in everything, especially in human capital. It's in everything, but it's also in the lives of our managers and supervisors and interactions among workforce and in teams. I mean, it's one of those things where you have to really know what it is and always be aware. And that this sort of helps, you know, it is a way to say how very important this is to the nation and to this administration who, you know, have really invited all of us to do strategic plans for DEIA, to really think about ways DEIA that is beyond the traditional in our government organizations. So thinking more broadly out into the country and where are there inequities in underserved populations in the services that government provides as an example of the much broader definition. So this fits really well into that effort to really make it broader than it has ever been before and to give it that kind of attention.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the window into the role of DEIA within the agency, but then also kind of specifically towards the mission, how that came from. So I know that you know, all of us will be certainly cheering that mission on, and all future missions. That this the work that continues to come out of NASA is mind expanding and just so exciting. Again, especially space nerd growing up in South Florida, you know, yes. I've been following the program for a very long time. Yeah, so yes. this is exciting moments for humanity. Last question I have for you before we move to the lightning round. You know, I knew having you on the podcast, a lot of people from my network and listeners from the podcast would have a lot of questions for you, and they did. There are a lot of tremendous questions. But I did pick one that I wanted to cover with you. And this one comes from Alina Merrick. And she asked, in an organization where communication is one of the most critical components of success, how do you utilize it to foster a culture that sparks human connections?
So I guess I would say the two things that I think of about communications is that they are intentional and they are personalized. And I think that kind of drives a lot of our efforts in communications at NASA. So when I say intentional, you know, people know how to do comms. You have communication specialists and they know how to do layered communications and target an audience, all that sort of thing. I think what matters, though, is that you're caring to communicate, that you're actually, and when I say that, it's at all levels. So the administrator communicates and the associate administrator and your project lead and your mission directorate and your home team and your function. And do you see what I'm saying? It's like this idea that people know that there's an importance in communicating so that we can make good decisions and so that people understand what they need to do and what flexibilities they have. But the personalized is, I think, more what she was getting at in the question. And I think, so we're a very people-oriented agency. We're very meeting-oriented. We've relied very heavily on sort of being in these field centers, literally being with each other and interacting in formal and informal ways. And obviously, we're having to shift how we do that now that we are more virtual. We will continue to be more of a mix of on-site and virtual going forward. So that we really put a premium on interpersonal connections, employee to employee. And I actually think that the supervisors and the work units are kind of a key. So I talk a lot about this, about the role of the supervisor and how they have to almost have superpowers. They do have superpowers. Supervisors have superpowers. Because I think they are where the work and the workforce come together. And they are in that unique position to ensure that not only are they contextualizing things, but they're also listening. And so over the last few years, there's been a lot of effort, intentionality, to really reach out one-on-one, to small groups, across, and of course, the tools that we have now that we really got used to using rather rapidly because of the pandemic are now enabling us to have that kind of interaction across the enterprise so that you know, we have people who work project teams who are not geographically in the same geography. They're at different field centers, right? So this is just another way for them to really make connections moment to moment, day to day. And so, again, I think it's that this idea that we are always focused on what did the employees need to know and the voice of the workforce too. I mean, we've actually put quite a bit of effort into surveys and mechanisms so that we understand what is going on. And so that's an important feature of the whole area of communication to ensure that we're not bothering them with stuff that they don't really need to know, but we're really being intentional about what we share so they feel like they're up to date. They know what's what. And so some of that's what makes an organization tick.
Yeah. I mean, and you break it down as if it's somewhat easy, but I know it's not, right? I think finding the right cadence of communication, style of communication, frequency of communication, platforms and methods for communicating. I mean, there's so many variables to this. Like, you know, the idea of discussing internal communication sounds simple, but there's so much complexity to it, and particularly in your environment where you're used to working in field centers and now you've got distributed employees,
right?
You have to lean more on asynchronous. It's interesting to kind of hear how you think through navigating that. Yeah. So, Gene, there's so many more questions I would love to get into with you, but I know that we have a timestamp podcast here, and I do want to get into the lightning round just to help the audience get to know you a little bit more before we wrap up. So we always start with music. Who are your top three artists? Who are you playing on repeat these days?
Well, I'm a classical musician, so minor classical choices. I'd say Yo-Yo Ma's at the top. Cellist. And then, of course, Arthur Rubinstein, whose Chopin Nocturnes are the best ever. And I listen to them every day. And Yuja Wang, who's another pianist, classical pianist. So those are some examples.
Okay. We're going to shift to TV or the screen. Now you're streaming. What was your latest binge on TV?
Well, it isn't actually new, but I'm still in love with it. That's The Great British Baking Show.
Okay. Wait, have you watched For All Mankind yet?
I haven't.
You have? Okay, so Jane and I had opportunity to meet in person in Dublin earlier this year, and For All Mankind, it's streaming on Apple Plus. I think it's on season 3 now.
Okay.
But again, they're getting a little more this season focused on the Mars race, and they landed on Mars, and I'm not going to give away anything other than that, but it's fascinating, at some point when you have some space, it's worth your time. It's like an alternate look at the space race, which I think could be interesting. And now, so I know you've worked in the field of HR throughout your career. We're going to have a career change. You can't do HR anymore. What would you be doing?
Chances are good I'll be thinking about not working full time, but instead teaching and writing and, of course, my music. So that's kind of where I'm headed. I actually really want to give back as well. So I came to government service later in my career. But what I realized was, you know, it matters. And I want people to understand that it matters and that government service of any kind, really, is a way to bring great joy into your life, even if you don't make as much money at it as you might doing something else, or there are other reasons why you wouldn't think of it as your first choice. But if, in terms of being meaningful, if you find meaning in work, that kind of federal service or service of any kind to organizations that are really oriented towards making the world a better place is great. So I might find some ways to give back. You know, I had a nice career in government towards the end, and I want to appreciate it and give back. So.
Yeah, I mean, hearing you describe that, I actually think that is in your future at some point. I think that is available to be to you, and it would not surprise me at all to see you doing that, you know, at some point down the road. So, well, Jane, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Thanks for sharing your work at NASA and giving us all a window into the work that you do at the agency. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Lars. It's been a great pleasure being with you and talking through all these things with you. It's just been really fun. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Redefining HR. For more information on the podcast, past episodes, future guests, the Redefining HR book, or free resources, be sure to check out redefininghr.com. And if you dig this podcast, why don't you share it with your CEO, your executive team, and your friends to help them discover what Redefining HR is all about. If you really dig this podcast, I'd love for you to leave a review on whatever podcast delivery vehicle your ears prefer. See you next week.